have a new committee, and we are now just waiting for members. So I'll just welcome everyone to the Senate Revenue Committee. It's a wonderful, rainy...
It's just the part where you tell them to get a real life.
What's today, Wednesday? Wednesday. Senator Corcoran had his anniversary just recently. We know that. And he went bowling last night. I know that. Oh. Tony's got his hand.
Hi, buddy. Come here and talk to me. Oh, he did? No, I don't. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to try to move him back. Why wouldn't we?
I think if we move him back, we'll probably work on it. Because I think then we can threaten the situation.
The mic is probably
once you're banging together.
That's true, that's the only go. Not so great.
Do you want me to hear?
Yeah, no, I think as soon as we get members here, we'll be ready to go.
Suppose you gave the party? No, you don't have to. In my afternoon here, it's at 3 o'clock.
I got about 3.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I once thought that was the only way things ever got reorganized. Because you have to throw everything on the ground.
So we are a thing again. We're on the right guard.
With?
So we're a subcommittee?
We are a subcommittee of the Revenue Committee, although we had a couple.
Mr. Chairman, I'm boycotting that committee. So. Put that in the record.
It is, yeah. You know, we're to calling this bill back, you know, the fiscal, and so we should have it all the minutes, right? Not correct.
I think that's how you do it in fiscal. So that's the question. I think you don't have this one. You have to do it that way. And the other question I have is the 12 million.
Thank you.
Mics are live, Senator.
Huh?
Mics are live, Senator.
Have you called Devlin and or Star and Ringo?
Was to call Star and Ringo?
Yeah, I just saw them. We were all in the same meeting.
Oh.
So I let them know that we were going to go first with 819.
Senator Devlin, so we're in work session. Maybe what we'll do is have you come reacquaint us with the bill, your bill 819. And Cindy, if you want to just be available to talk about Senator Corcoran's Dash 1 amendments, which I think he's retrieving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 819 adjusts the formula for the local option from 10% of ADMW to 15% of ADMW as a maximum, the amount per ADMW, and from $500 to $750 maximum per ADMW. As you're all well aware, the legislature passed the local option in the 99 session, and this is a modest adjustment to it. In addition to that, you're probably aware of the equalization formula that exists for local options. That if you are in a community that has an assessed value that's below a certain level and you still have the area under Measure 5 still available in terms of what you can levy, that it will bring you up to the 75th percentile of what school districts could levy under a local option, even if your assessed value would not put you at that level. An example of that is going on here while you get committee members. An example of that is the Pendleton School District that levies about $300,000 in their local option and also gets another $160,000 from the state under the local option equalization formula. So they get about $1.60 in total, a dollar that they raise locally and 60 additional states from this additional 60 cents additional, in a sense, outside the formula in their local option equalization grant. What that basically equals for the Pendleton School District is they raise about $300,000 in their local option, and in the local option equalization grant from the state, they receive about another $155,000.
Thank you. And I had erred, so I'm going to open committee. We will do, I have not opened a work session. We will do, I think we'll do in order, Senate Bill 819 first, then Senator Farioli's bill, which is Senate Bill 639, and then those who are waiting for Senate Bill 601, we will do that one last.
Mr. Chairman, are we waiting for Senator Starr also?
We're waiting for a full committee. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 819. Senator Corcoran, if you want to talk about your amendment.
I am. They are en route.
Oh.
I'll talk about them, though. Basically, Mr. Chair, I've been trying to find a vehicle, trying to find a way to love 819 because I don't like it. And I found a way to like it, and that is to fix another problem that exists. I've had some assistance from some of the school finance people. I have a two school districts, adjacent school districts in North Douglas County. North Douglas is one, it's in Drain, and the other one's in Yonkala. And they recently have had very serious merger talks and were just on the brink of merging when they discovered that to merge and combine their high schools, they would lose $250,000 because of the impact of the, I'm not exactly sure of the name of the offset, but it's rural and remote. Is that it, Steve?
The small school correction.
The small school correction, okay. And anyway, it was a disincentive to merge. And, you know, looking at the current economics, in my district alone, I have about 14 small school districts and then 4J in Eugene. And I know of merger talks that have gone on with at least six of those school districts because of the economic straits. And so what my amendment would do is it would simply withhold any economic impact schools currently under the small school correction factor harmless for two biennia, 4 years. And at that point, we would have to try to look at what the, you know, what their financial status is after having gone through that transition for 4 years.
Thank you.
And you want to come up and talk?
It'd be nice if maybe John, do you want to be the designee from the school community to?
Cindy Hunt just drafted this up for me, and actually Ozzie's not here, I don't think. Ozzie helped me come up with this solution.
John is subbing for.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's Committee. The amendments, basically as Senator Corcoran described them, they make an adjustment to the small high school weighting formula by saying that if two small high schools merge, then the Department of Ed for the next four distribution years continues to add to the ADMW of the school district where the small high schools are located, or were located rather, the same weight that they would have received had they not merged. And that's it in a nutshell.
For 4 years.
For 4 years. And 4 years only.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Board Association. I was aware that there was some discussion of this concept, and we believe it's a good one. There have been merger discussions not only in the North Douglas area, but I'm also aware of discussions that have gone on in Lowell County between Joseph and Enterprise. So I think as the funding is reduced and districts start to look at the different avenues of providing educational services, mergers between neighboring school districts might in fact be one of those options, and creating sort of a safety net for a couple years, creating in effect an incentive for those school districts to merge.
Committee. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Let me just comment. I think both of these concepts are good ideas on their own, and I think it's unfortunate that we have to stick them together, but I would have been glad to support Senator Corcoran's concept just on its own merits, because I think it is a good idea.
Unfortunately, I can't send over anything over to the other side of the building with my name on it, so I just have to have it go through 819.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, that was very blunt. What panel would you like? Other questions for the panel? Thank you. Thank you.
And I want to especially thank Cindy Hunt, Mr. Chair. She was beyond call of duty today. She snapped that thing out immediately. Thank you.
Cindy is wonderful.
Send him a bill, Cindy.
I will.
Until you're better paid. Thank you.
Committee, we're in work session.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannah.
Is there a revenue impact or a fiscal impact on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, no, I have just seen this as soon as you have. It would not increase the ADMW extended at all. It would just keep it from perhaps dropping a little bit. But I don't see any great impact, and there won't be any until there's a merger of these districts anyway. And I have no way of knowing when that might be.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Do we have a motion to adopt the dash ones on the table?
We do not.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved that we adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 819. Any discussion? Any objections?
I object.
Can you call the roll, Taylor?
Cochran?
Aye.
Hannon?
No.
Ringo?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Ariel?
No.
Eckert?
Aye. Motion passes.
Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I move that we pass Senate Bill 819 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 819 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I've been continuously requesting some assistance with Senate Bill 747, and I think you and other members of the committee know that that's a very important issue to me. And the concept of increasing options, local initiatives and local options, is an important concept. But I see no time commitment support for local options that would fit under this same sort of rubric, including additional federal appropriations for rural schools. And until I see that time commitment support for that concept, I won't be supporting any local initiatives or local options unless I see there is some recognition that, in fact, we are in this together. We need new tools to deal with this issue. And so I'll be registering a protest vote on this bill. Not that I don't support the concept, but I don't see cooperation from this committee on the issue that's very important to my rural constituents.
Mr. Chairman, I would not only echo that, but I think this turns a situation. It's very unfortunate that we started a dialogue on Monday this week in the leadership meeting between the Senate Democratic leader and the Republican leader and the Senate president and myself, and this totally blows it up and says, well, this is a rural-urban split, go forth and to hell with you. And for that reason, I'm going to be opposing it as well, and I think it's unfortunate that we have chosen to drive a wedge between communities rather than trying to bring them together.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Corcoran.
I feel like I'm on the committee for schizophrenia, but I don't support a local option. I didn't support a local option. In discussions with Senator Devlin and yourself and some others, you've made the point that the local option itself has passed and that this is simply a an adjustment to it. And hardly any schools have taken advantage of the local option as it exists. And with regard to the federal timber money, I totally agree with my two colleagues. I have a different read on whether or not we can get there through this particular vehicle, 819. I will be absolutely supporting reconnecting with leadership if this bill passes over to the House side to try to ensure that that federal money is at least divvied up in the same proportion that it was the last time. I disagreed with that to the extent that I think the money was very clearly earmarked for rural distressed communities, and I think we put that continuing federal assistance very much at risk by not using the money for which it was intended. But the compromise was the compromise. That's politics. But I would hope that, Senator, that we would be able to look at not only the timber but the other issues that were on the table as well and not feel that just the movement of this bill alone would deep six us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I think that we've got a lot of school revenue issues that are on the table, and we'll have a lot more of those discussions as we move forward in the next few weeks of this session. And I don't necessarily believe that the movement of Senate Bill 819 that provides a modest adjustment in the already established local option does anything to preclude ongoing discussions. And I expect and I hope and I believe and I know that those ongoing discussions about how we're going to fund schools in this state will cease or stop.
I expect that they will continue. I encourage that, and I just don't see that the modest change that is in this bill really has plays a big role in that overall discussion that needs to take place about how are we going to fund education in this state, both in my school districts in Washington County or those in the more rural parts of the state. Obviously, we've got to find common ground, some common denominator, and yet I don't believe that this bill really is of the magnitude that should make a big difference in that overall debate or discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm supposed to say something. I really disagree with the remark that this exacerbates the urban-rural divide. It's not intended to do that. It doesn't have to do that. I think everyone would prefer to see a statewide solution to our school funding problem, but we shouldn't let the absence of that solution prevent local districts from trying to do something to save their own schools. And when I go back to my district up in Beaverton and I run into parents who say that they're bailing out of the public school system because our state can't get its act together, that should send fear to all of us down in this building, because that saps the strength for supporting schools all over the state. And I think it's in the strong interest of urban and rural to try to make sure that schools succeed in every community. And we should at least allow for local communities to take care of their own schools until our state can come to an overarching solution.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you. This is a modest change. There's no question about that. As far as I'm concerned, the purpose of 819 is a good purpose. There's no question in my mind about that. I agree that the absence of a greater solution, a more overarching solution, should not prevent either local communities from seeking a solution or stop the process. But, Mr. Chairman, I've asked for a demonstration of good faith. You and I have met rather continuously about this issue. We've included other members of this committee. Your indication to me is that you are not looking for a vehicle to compromise this issue. You've indicated that there may be some unspecified future opportunity to do that. That is not, in my opinion, a demonstration of good faith. So the question for me is whether or not I see progress being made toward a solution to resolve the issue of lack of capacity that Senator Corcoran has referred to in rural communities to seek local option solutions, the strong support we've seen for local initiatives from the professionals in the education field and those that desire to not to stand in the way of those local solutions. What essentially is being requested from this committee is a recognition that those issues, until they are addressed, will stand as an obstacle to cooperation. And we're asking, essentially, I'm asking this committee to help find a resolution by looking diligently and in good faith for opportunities to resolve the solution. And, Mr. Chairman, that effort so far is lacking. So I will not be supporting this bill. As a matter of fact, I think the continued participation on this committee, as far as I'm concerned, is in question at this point. So I will be withdrawing from the committee hearing today. Respectfully request that you reschedule Senate Bill 639, which is on the agenda today.
Well, on 639, we have a number of folks who've come down for it, so I'd like to have a hearing. Committee, the reason that this bill is before you is because there was a request made Monday that we hold the bill off for a couple of days, and we're doing just that. And I said at that point that we would have a work session, unless I heard otherwise, Wednesday afternoon. So that is the inclination of the chair, is to hold a work session Wednesday afternoon.
And, Mr. Chairman, have we not continuously conversed about the issue of good faith efforts to find a vehicle to compromise? And has that occurred?
On Senate Bill 747, I will speak for myself. I feel open to, although I do not feel Senate Bill 819 is one that would fall into those discussions.
Mr. Chairman, I'm referring to the active solicitation of vehicles that by this committee to use as compromise. Have we been doing that?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's inconsistent with statements you've made to me personally.
So we have a motion on the floor to pass Senate Bill 819 as amended. Any further discussion? Kara, help a roll, please.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Daniel?
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. The motion, the bill passes. Senator Devlin, I don't know if you want to carry this bill.
let me.
It is.
Will I carry this bill yet?
Okay, Senator Devlin will carry the bill, and others will help you out with it. With that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 639. Very well, he's just unreasonable. How are you doing?
Very good.
Mr. Yates, what does this bill do?
You should have three sheets of paper, which I sort of wanted to go over on top of the pile. The first is simply the staff measure summary. And what that tells you is that the only change in the bill is to the minimum distribution from the emergency communications account. And what we're dealing with here is the 75-cent per month access charge to be able to access emergency telephone communications. The minimum in the existing law is 1%. This changes that to $360,000. And that's the only change in the bill, except that it does require that minimum be indexed. The second page shows you what I think is a problem in the bill. If you take the most recent quarter, you had about $7.6 million in money that flowed into the emergency communications account. And you have the allocations which come off the top there to the Department of Revenue for administration, Office of Emergency Management for administration. And then 35% goes into enhanced 911 subaccount, and another 2.5% into the enhanced 911 equipment replacement subaccount. The balance then that would be available for distribution to the local PSAPs would be $4.4 million. And if you take 36 counties times a minimum per county of $360,000, you get a minimum distribution of $12.9 million. So it's hard to take $4 million and, you know, distribute $12 million.
Mm-hmm.
And in the two boxes below, I tried to get at what I think the sponsors might be interested in or aiming at. The current 1% from this distribution would give a minimum quarterly distribution of $44,000, which on a biennial basis would be $353,000. And that seems very close to the $360,000 that's in the bill, so I suspect that was meant to be a biennial total, but I don't know. And the other is just the average distribution that you would get per county of about $122,000 on a quarterly basis. And so you can see how that might compare with the minimum distribution of about $45,000. Excuse me. The third page, then, is an attempt to estimate what revenues you can expect to receive in the upcoming biennium from the 911 access charge. In that, as you can see, I've used two different models. I actually ran about eight different models, but only have 6 years of data where the tax rate has been constant, so it's not a model that one derives a lot of confidence from. But the linear model gave me an estimate of about $70.6 million, and a percentage change model a little higher, about $73 million. And then I guess the question is there more money there than is needed, essentially, by the Office of Emergency Management and by the system as a whole? And I guess I want to distribute one more sheet of paper here, which is what the Office of Emergency Management has been using, essentially, as their in connection with their talks before Ways and Means. And what that shows is an expected total revenue, their estimate of $64 million. So that's somewhat below the estimate that I've made there, $6 to $8 million.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So assuming, even Dick, that this gets repaired, one thing that would be helpful is to see a side-by-side comparison of what the PSEP's got in, you know, the last 2 years versus what this change, how this change might affect them. I'm thinking, you know, I've got Oak Ridge, Cottage Grove, and Eugene, and I would just like to see on a chart what the impact would be by making this change in the formula. So I don't know, how many PSEPs are there in the state? 53?
We'll get some of this in testimony.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's more than 36.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
And you?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Yates. Sina,
do you want to come up? And Mr. Schneider from AOC?
You were going to defer to the opponent.
Yeah, oh, that would be great. We have one of our proponents has left us.
Forever, maybe.
In his stead, Judge. Judge. Afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Judge Mike MacArthur, Sherman County. In this capacity, the vice chair of TRICOM, which is a three-county communications agency formed between Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties to try in an attempt to provide 911 services to our counties. We currently don't have a PSAP. We almost do. We're within a month or so of opening our first public safety answering point in those three counties ever. I've offered you an article from the Oregonian, I think that was quite timely, that showed up yesterday, that talks about 911 service throughout the country. And I think Oregon can be quite proud of the record it has with 911 service, having the state covered, I believe, since 1991. You can see many states to the our neighbors, there are places where there isn't 911 coverage.
Judge, we just need to get your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I said Judge Mike MacArthur, Sherman County.
He did great.
He did.
I still am.
We want some proof, please.
In our effort to establish and operate a public safety answering point, we've needed to save the 911 phone tax dollars that were available to us for many years and had to contract for those services with other counties. Currently, it's Morrow County has been our provider of services. The difference is between being a renter and an owner. And you know how you control the establishment when you're an owner versus when you're a renter and the types of services you can provide. And we want to provide improved services to the people in our area and the people moving through our area. A great deal of recreation goes on in that area, in the rivers around our counties, in the mountains and hills. And we have a great many visitors. Those three counties have the highest per capita incidence of trauma accidents in the state. Much higher than any other areas, partly because of low population, the way statistics work, but because of remote areas that we have and because people recreating there. So we're trying to provide better service, better 911 service in our area. Our concern was there was a great deal of talk about redoing the formula for 911 phone tax distribution, and our fear was that in that discussion, some of the proposals had us eliminated from any funding whatsoever. Those three counties just cut off. So the purpose of the bill, and Senator Farrelly was kind enough to have actually the council draw it up for us, was to provide us some insurance that we'd have a continued source of funding to be able to operate this PSAP that we're just about to create. Now, I know the language is somewhat confusing. I don't know if I agree with the interpretation that was given about what the intent was. The intent was to provide a very basic minimum for operations for a public safety transiting point, and the related services that go with it. Because, of course, in rural areas, you don't have paid staff. So you're relying on volunteers to respond, in most cases, to the call for services. So those people are people in the community walking around with pagers on their hip. And so we have to have a infrastructure in place to get those people notified to go jump in the ambulance or go jump on the fire truck that we got a problem. And so you need radio systems to be able to connect to those volunteers that man your services. And so there are other things necessary. You need to maintain a rural addressing system so that people can find the locations where the accidents and injuries are taking place. So money needs to be spent on other things besides just the telephone system. And the administrative rules for 911 envision that and allow that. And so we think it's important that each county have a base to be able to provide basic level 911 service. And it appears that we're moving towards a study of what it really takes to provide 911 services. And there's agreement amongst the parties that maybe this formula change won't happen just yet. And that's the position, I think, if I can speak for AOC here, I think that's AOC's position, is we need to really take a fundamental look at what it takes to provide 911 services statewide and how best to establish that. So In responding to Senate Bill 639, it may be premature to act on that bill at this point. I'm happy to take questions.
You're not a proponent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I think Judge MacArthur has pretty fairly characterized our position with respect to a whole host of 911 bills that are coming up this legislative session. We support a continuation of the funding level per county as it is today until an appraisal and review can be done of what the appropriate cost is to provide a seamless 911 system across the state.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Corcoran.
So in that context, is there such a study going on right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think APCO NENA plans to conduct such a study, and Hasina Squires would be in a better position to tell us that than I would.
We dumped it on you, Hasina.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires appearing today on behalf of the Oregon chapters of APCO NENA, which is essentially the 911 Managers Association. At this point, the legislature has not directed Associated Public Safety Communications Officials / National Emergency Number Association.
That is the worst acronym I have heard this session. That beats Terry Thompson's acronym, if you'll remember, about the Oregon fisheries folks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, hence why I just quickly breezed over that and just moved on.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And hence Senator Corcoran would not allow you to
Very duly noted. At this point, the legislature has not directed anyone to study that issue. There are, in my testimony, and I, Mr. Chair, I'll just defer to you on how much of that testimony, in light of the comments that Judge MacArthur has made, that you want me to go through today, because I think we all have a different interpretation of what this, I think between Mr. Yates, myself, and Mr. MacArthur, we may all interpret the bill differently, which is fine. But I'll defer to you on how much of the testimony you want me to go through, but there is, in fact, another piece of legislation that alters this minimum county funding distribution down in the House General Government Committee. And so within the context of that legislation, we also oppose that, too, and have advocated that in order to determine what is an appropriate level of funding, we need to know what is the cost per call per service to provide seamless statewide 911 system, and that issue is being discussed down in the House General Government Committee. So no, to answer your question very briefly now, no, there is no study underway, but we encourage that to occur in whatever avenue it does.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I mean, I'm very sympathetic to Judge MacArthur's, description of the needs, and, I mean, this is a way to kind of socialize those costs so that they're spread. I mean, the 75 cents is for all services all through the state, and it would seem to me that if we had a, you know, if redistribution needs to be done to accommodate the lack of economies of scale, for instance, that you have over in Eastern Oregon, then we should do that. But this seems like just sort of a blanket look at it without the data to support it. And I don't think, you know, you need legislative direction, not you, but Hasina's group, to, you know, to give the legislature that kind of information so we could, you know, make adjustments where we need to make adjustments.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corkin, if I could just respond to that. If you'll look on page 2 of my testimony, really that is the position of the association under bullet number 1. Really, we do encourage that exploration of what that cost is in conjunction with reviewing the existing 75-cent 911 tax sunset, which will occur in the 2007 legislative session. So it is something that we're looking at. But there are, as you know, a whole host of, hopefully as you know, a whole host of other issues that are being debated on the House side and probably in Ways and Means with respect to the appropriate level of taxation and appropriate level of the number of PSAPs and whether or not they should be regionally provided versus at the local level. And so there are a number of issues going on. And our association is dedicated to preserving two things, maintaining the existing tax as it currently exists, making sure that we receive full revenue expenditure limitation authority from the Ways and Means process, and that's where our focus is at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a particular personal interest in this because I've told this story before. I mean, when they moved the state police barracks out of Cottage Grove to Springfield and centralized them, we reported a burglary, and when the state police officer got to the bottom of our road, she called us and asked us where the hell we were. I mean, that would have never happened had it been out of Cottage Grove. So I'm very sensitive to the fact that when they were trying to regionalize during the last session, I wasn't very interested in that. I mean, I'd much rather have, you know, somebody local that knows where things are. So. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't mind doing, you know, Eastern Oregon out of Beaverton. That's a, you know, local option.
So, Hasina, I think you got it in your bullet number 1. Is your organization's position is that you feel y'all should study this and then bring something to us that better encapsulates all the different regions of Oregon's interest. Is that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, really, truly, I mean, this minimum funding, which is what it is for counties, and it was, I mean, to the best of my understanding, I wasn't here in 1981, but it was really meant to provide a minimum basic level of funding to the county so we could get 911 systems up and operating through the state of Oregon. And on page 1 of my testimony is just a quick, brief history of what's happened to that. It started out as a minimum of 0.25%, and then it was increased in 1987 to 0.75%, and then in 1995 to a minimum of 1%. This bill, the way I interpret it, would change that minimum 1% either on an annual basis or a biannual basis. I'm unclear on what the bill does, and that hence the two spreadsheets that we prepared for your review would change that minimum funding distribution from 1% to a flat $360,000 in to each county that qualified for the minimum distribution. And so if you'll look on the second to last page of my testimony, the first spreadsheet, that if you'll look in the fourth column over, that says current biennium total 4 quarters, this would be the impact of this legislation as I've described it, as changing it from 1% funding to minimum distribution to a $360,000 annual distribution. And as you can see, the counties beginning with Umatilla, Benton County, skipping over Josephine, all the counties below that would lose a great deal of money. The next page is if it were a biennial $360,000 distribution. And as you can see, Senator Deckard and Senator Starr, that Washington County is in fact a very large loser under the way the bill is interpreted in that scenario. So we don't support this legislation, and we don't support the legislation that's pending down in the House General Government Committee for the reasons that we've already stated regarding the need to study the issue and determine whether or not people are receiving the appropriate level of funding.
So are these millions? So is it like for Marion, is it a loss of $2.1 million? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to defer to our APCO-NENA president, Lynn Iverson, who's here from LINCOM, who prepared these spreadsheets. I think she would probably be better to speak to the data in the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
May I comment on the intent of the bill? Uh-huh. Intent of the bill was not to limit to a flat fee statewide. The intent of the bill was to provide a floor. Mm. And then the distributions would grow from there. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's not being interpreted that way.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
So is there still a response needed?
I think it's millions, right? That was the
millions,
only question
yes,
I had.
That's correct.
Great. Appreciate all the work on this. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on Senate Bill 639? Closed hearing on Senate Bill 639. Sarah Beyer is next door, and the next bill is his. So we if there's a way to let him know this bill is up.
And you can listen to his testimony by yourself, I guess.
Stay just there. He's in one of the hearings, either next door or
Congress.
Tom Petoskey's here.
Roger
Byer, yeah.
Tom was here, but I didn't see him.
Yeah. Public hearing on Senate Bill 601. Senator Beyer, sorry to interrupt you from your committee.
No problem. They're just talking about payday loans, so who cares?
You're glad to be here, then.
Yeah.
I know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. Before you is Senate Bill 601, and hopefully you also have a -2 amendment to Senate Bill 601 in your possession. This bill, as drafted, was, I believe, identical to House Bill 2705, which there is currently, I think it's the House Revenue Committee, is working on. And I requested a hearing on this bill just so that people would understand that there is one on each side, and hopefully the House Committee will incorporate or at least look at the amendments I have offered to the bill, and we can work on a single bill and get one moving through the process, whether it be this one or that one, whichever direction the tide flows, it doesn't matter to me. But I came up with this bill because, as you all very well know, having been in the legislature for almost as long as I have, Mr. Chair, and almost as long as Senator Starr, that in our time, or at least in my time in the legislature, we have had difficulty in forecasting, getting the forecast what I would call extremely accurate. And that's not to say anything negative about any of the forecasters we have had or any of the job they do. They have an extremely difficult job, and I recognize that. But I was in Hawaii this December and had a discussion with the now chairman of the Senate Ways and Means Committee for the Washington Legislature, who is Senator Dino Rossi. And we talked about the revenue forecasting process they use in the state of Washington, and he told me about it and informed me how it works up there. And he had been a minority member, his party had been a minority his entire service until just now. And what struck me about that is, as a minority member of the legislature, he was complimentary how good the process worked and how fair it was, how open it was, and seemingly how accurate it was. And I don't know if any of you have seen this graph, but this is a graph that shows projections versus actual collections for the Washington. And this is from July of 2000 through November of 2002. And
We have that, or
I don't know if you have that or not, Mr. Chair. I can certainly make it available to you if you do not have it. But the thing that struck me by this is that, with the exception of the small dip right here, which is, for information, November of 2001, happens to be right after, you know, September 11th, which everyone took a dip, you will see the lines virtually are one on top of the other. And I reflected with my comparison to my experience here since I've been in the building, and the best has been, since I've been in the building, is 97, 99, when we were a little more than 2% off. And as, I mean, it's very difficult in our process to project, but as you all know, that when we get more than 2% off in a positive way, the kicker kicks. Here is a graph that shows that the deviation that we've seen versus, you know, the middle line here would be an accurate, you know, exact number. In 90, we could start in, if I go back to 91, we were approximately 2% off, a little over 2%. 1993, 95 session, we were about a little over 5.5%, close to 6. 1995, 97, almost 10% off. 97, 99, as I already said, a little more than 2%. 99, 01, about 2.5%. And, of course, we all know what happened in 01, 03. I don't need to bring that one back up. But as you see, you know, from the chart, and I'm just not saying anything negative about the former forecaster or the current forecaster, who is both in the room, by the way, but it is very difficult to make an accurate projection. What this bill is trying to do is model as close as we can with the Dash 2 amendments to the Washington. What they do there is they have a committee set up by the legislative and governor committee, two members from each party in the House and Senate, two members appointed by the governor. Those six members choose the revenue officer in the state of Washington, and that revenue officer then reports back to this committee and gets input from the committee before they release and before they make official the forecasts. And as I said, by a person who served in the minority up there for his entire legislative career, he said that system has worked very well. In fact, he said he was one of the members of the minority members of the Washington committee that does this. What this bill does, because our Constitution says that the governor shall present a forecast and the kicker is based on the governor's forecast, we can't go as far as that Washington model without changing the Constitution. So what I've attempted to do is try to get as close to that as we can by having a committee. It would be a standing committee of the legislature, two members of the Senate, two from the House, and then two members, one appointed by the governor and one appointed by the state treasurer. I guess just a little bit different twist. That's what the House version came up with. These members would not only receive the forecast, but prior to receiving the official forecast, they would have an opportunity to look at the numbers, the range of the forecast, the information that the revenue officer used to create the forecast, and put input into that number. And I would say that I bring that up because as members of the legislature, we are much closer to our local districts and to the, you know, the state as a whole as to what's happening. The revenue officer is looking at, you know, global issues, state issues, national issues, but they might be not realizing what's happened at the local levels. And this committee would have an opportunity to take a look at that, the information that goes into these revenue forecasts, and provide feedback and suggestions that that person may not have taken into account. I mean, maybe a new business is starting up in your district, in Washington County, or maybe in the farm economy is all of a sudden for some reason, you know, drought or some insect or something like that, that, you know, it comes up. The revenue officer may not know about that information, so just a chance to get more information into it. I believe in my discussions with the state economists now, that they try to take all that into account. They look at a range of things from optimistic to pessimistic. Another thing that really opened my eyes when I was talking with Senator Rossi in Washington was I asked them what their projected revenue outcome or, you know, picture was for the state of Washington for the 03-05 biennium. And they said they were projecting about a 7% growth. Their range, I think, was from 2% to 11%, and they chose the 7% because this committee in Washington actually chooses the number that they're going to use to set their legislative budget. If they can't, unable to reach a decision, then the number goes to the most the middle-of-the-road number, but they have that option. We don't have that option because of our Constitution. But they chose 7%. I checked with California, or actually our staff checked with California, and in California they're looking at about a 2% biennial growth. Yet in Oregon we're still predicting a double digit. Actually, I think our number now is right near 10% with the latest revenue forecast.
About 11.
11. Mm-hmm. So, and it got me asking the question, what are we doing different in Oregon? We think we're going to grow at a much faster rate than either our neighbor to the north or the south. And my hope would be that by having this sort of a system in place, we'd be able to get a more accurate forecast, because we take not just the look of the economists, but look of legislators who could come from around the state, different political parties, and maybe get a different perspective. The bill as drafted also set up a new board and a new office. And if you look at the amendments, which is fine. I have no problem doing that. I don't think we need two forecasting offices. So if you look at Section 6 in the amendment, we put in the Office of Economic Analysis of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services is abolished. And that's would just be this new office would also be in the Department of Administrative Services, new name, kind of the same functions, just a little bit differently the way it's set up. I don't think we need two separate entities doing virtually the same thing. I'm not married to either one. As I said, this is the House, the way the bill came out, the House version set up this new office. I think either one would work fine. I think the way this bill is set up, the new office brings in a little more maybe mixed opinions also, and tries to get some outside looks at the process. But with that, Mr. Chair, there is I understand a work session tomorrow on House Bill 2705. I hope to be to attend that and be able to present my amendments to this bill to that group, so we can look at, hopefully we can come together in agreement on what this whole thing should look like, mm-hmm. and get a process moving. Because and a companion measure, I guess, I have would be SJR 26, which sets a spending limit cap, builds a stabilization fund, and at the same time suspends the kicker until that fund is filled for the first time.
Where is SJR 26? Is that in rules?
That bill is in rules. It held its first public hearing yesterday.
It did.
Huh. But I think what's important to note is that if we have accurate forecasts and can keep our forecast within 2%, there's not going to be a kicker to even talk about. And I think that's what we would all strive for, to have the most accurate forecast as possible. Mm-hmm. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions of you or your esteemed committee who is here in such great attendance today.
Paul, how does this bill mesh with what's happening in the House?
Mr. Chair, first of all, the Senate Bill 601 is identical to House Bill 2705, so the original one is exactly the same. The difference comes in this amendment, the -2 amendment, and the 2705 amendments. What the amendments have done on the House side is Senator Byers referring to there's a revenue forecast board in this bill, but there's also an advisory committee that's set up. And basically what what that amendment does on 2705 eliminates that advisory committee and essentially puts that in the discretion of the state economist, who I think will have some comments on moving to set up a second step of advice, because right now he's got a system where the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors reviews the economic numbers but does not review the revenue numbers. And so this would require that, but if we pull that out through an amendment, then that would be done. It could either be done through executive order or through DAS procedures, and that's something the state economists can discuss. The biggest difference between the amendment on the House side and Senator Byers' amendment on the 601-2 is the legislative participation, mm-hmm. In the Revenue Forecast Board. The board in the original bill doesn't have any exclude legislators, but does not have any anticipated participation there. This clearly does, and also an active participation. If you look on the amendment line 15, to receive information from and provide advice to. And that differs from 2705. 2705 sees this board as receiving the information, ensuring that the final revenue forecast numbers are received by legislative leadership and executive leadership simultaneously, and also participating in the hiring of the state economist and providing input to the governor on that final choice. So the big difference here in the 601 and the dash twos is the active participation on the part of legislators who are appointed to this board. I do, by the way, have a written description from their website that Tom Petowski sent over on the Washington Forecast Council.
Mm.
So that's from their website.
I guess, Senator Byer, that would be my only concern is in this whole discussion is turning. I want to ensure the independence, and I think in some ways your bill is focused in that same direction, the independence. And I guess that the only concern of getting the legislature, I just think we have to be careful in that arena of how much we might insert the legislature into and provide advice to, because I think the worst case scenario would be that these forecasts become politicized, which I know we're all probably always in danger of, but that would be the biggest thing in the back of my mind.
Mr. Chair, and I would agree entirely, and and that's why, as I told you, coming from a senator in Washington who served on this board in Washington, always in the minority party mm-hmm. prior to now, has said this board takes politics out of it.
Yes.
And because they have to get a majority of members and to come up with an agreement on the number or on who they choose as their revenue officer in Washington. And I think that in Washington, if my memory serves me correctly, they've had a Democrat governor up there now for at least two terms, possibly more. And the Democrats have controlled at least one, if not both, chambers of the legislature up there for as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. And so this was a Republican member said, this takes the politics out of it. Mm-hmm. And that was very striking to me, mm-hmm. was to have him say that, a person who's been a minority. This bill doesn't have two members from the governor's office. It has one from the governor's office, one from the treasurer's office. That was the House decision on how to actually introduce the bill. I personally would feel comfortable with two members from the governor's office, but at the same time, we have to realize in Oregon, if we're to adopt the 601-2 amendments, the legislative body could provide advice, but they cannot influence because the Constitution says the governor's office, that the governor shall set the forecast. So we can say anything we want under these amendments, but it's still the governor's office, DAS, Mr. Petowski's job to set the number. Mm-hmm. He can take advice from the legislators and say, they're all wet, I'm going this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll sit and complain, as we do now.
Sure, we do now, yeah. Thank you. Tom, do you want to come up, Senator, if you want to stay,
sure.
Have Mr. Petowski up and... We should be getting the House bill in a few weeks if they pass it out tomorrow.
Hi. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski, a state economist with Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services. I think for comments on the bill, both 601 and House Bill 2705, we're in essence agreement with the direction for these bills. Our office for a while has been discussing the need to have a revenue advisory committee to help us on that leg of the forecasting process. We've also started to talk about our revenue forecast with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors within the context of the economic forecast. So that we're very much, our biggest desire is to make the forecast as accurate as possible. So what we would like to see is the governor's Council of Economic Advisors that is made up of a committee of some of the top economists in the state and would like to expand out their functions and then have a sort of revenue advisory committee be made up of possibly a subgroup of them plus other individuals that have knowledge. There's things like tax law that may affect the tax-paying behavior that we may not be aware of, are not sure how the behavior might go. That would be very useful for us to have on that type of committee. But in terms of the sections of the state, we don't have complete, I would say, you know, people from each sector of the state. And part of the problem is the we meet 8 times a year. And to get people from like far eastern Oregon to come over would be difficult. We have a member from the coast in Yahats area. We have a member from Bend. But it is probably heavily, and because of the profession and where the professionals might be located, it's still heavy in the upper Willamette Valley area, really. We do get assistance from our employment departments that have their regional offices around the state to see what's happening in the economy. And we welcome, of course, any information that help make the process better. I think from the governor's office, they are concerned about politicizing the process, whether in perception or not, I think is also a question from their office, even though I think as Senator Beyer mentioned, given the separation of powers and that it does still with the executive branch, that's where the ultimate decision lies, and there would be advisory input from the Dash 2 amendments that Senator Beyer has. The other part the governor is interested in is to make sure that the governor's Council of Economic Advisors, which has been in the past a very prestigious, I think, committee for these people to be involved with, to have them play still a central role in this process. And that's really the two, I think, main things, I think, probably from the governor's office that they're concerned.
And you've been engaged with the House committee, the House Revenue.
Yes.
We'll have, Senator Beyer, we'll have this bill, although it sounds like you're going to attend the work session tomorrow. We'll have this bill before us, it sounds like, in a month or so.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your willingness to hear this bill today. As I said, I just want to make sure that we have a bill moving in one direction or the other, mm-hmm. and that we would like to come to consensus with, you know, the House, the Governor's office, because I think the most, you know, as I said, main thing I'm looking for is an accurate non-political forecast. And if you have an accurate forecast, obviously it's not going to be a political forecast because it's reflecting what's right. truly happening mm-hmm. in Oregon. And that's the goal of myself and Senator Burdick. We co-sponsored this legislation and recognizing mm-hmm. that some of our constituents might not be happy if they aren't getting a kicker check every other year. But at the same time, it's true we have an accurate forecast and it's something we can build our budget on and we can work forward that way.
My feeling is everyone seems to be saying the same thing on this, and to have Senator Beyer and Senator Burdick co-sponsoring this bill, I think, is very monumental in and of itself.
There's about two or three of those around this time, people that, you know, wondering what's happening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anything Mr. Else? Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Close. Anyone else? 601. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 601, and we are done, and... Tim, we are adjourned.